Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Dr. Milton Mills. Thanks for being with us on the show.
Hi, I'm happy to be here this morning.
Well, Milton, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got interested in a plant-based diet?
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version, and then if you need me to expand on anything, I'll be happy to do so. When I was in my sort of teenage years, I became a Seventh-day Adventist. I joined the Seventh-day Adventist Church when I was about 14. And the Seventh-day Adventist Church has as one of its core tenets the belief that all people should be plant-based, because in the Bible, it right up front, one of the first instructions God gave to Adam and Eve in Genesis 1:29 was to eat an entirely plant-based diet. And so church teaches that this is how we were designed and this is what's healthiest for. And it's the diet that we all should try to eat. Now, it does not require that we do that, but it does encourage us to do that. And I will say that after I joined the church, I didn't think that I could be vegetarian. I just thought, well, you know, I can't live without a hamburger or an occasional steak. And that went on for about a year and a half. But then I had reached the point where I was struggling with some personal issues, and I was praying about it one night, and I really felt God telling me, if you want to have a closer relationship with me, you need a clearer mind, and for that, you need a better diet. You got to stop eating meat.
Hmm.
It was very clear. And so my response at that point was, okay, God, if this is what you want me to do, take away the desire to eat meat. And he did. And that was back in September of 1974.
Wow.
Back when I went vegetarian 41 years ago, about the only meat alternative you could get was from the Seventh-day Adventist company Loma Linda.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think they helped change a lot of people with their products.
Right, right. Yeah, you're absolutely right. There was no such thing as walking into Safeway or some other, conventional store and finding vegan or even vegetarian alternatives. So yeah, the world has changed a lot. I back then there used to be ladies in the church who knew how to make seitan from whole wheat flour,
uh-huh.
And which has become a lost art. But yeah, I could contact them and ask them to do that for me, and they go and get the whole wheat flour, and a couple days later I could come pick up my seitan. So yeah, it's a very different world.
I tried making my own once. It caused a big mess in the kitchen and took a long, long time.
Yeah, it's definitely something that you have to have the skills to do. I've never even attempted.
Well, I've eaten a lot of it.
Yeah.
I tend to specialize in eating rather than
right,
eating.
But, fast forwarding a bit, you ended up deciding to pursue the practice of medicine. And I'm curious about your experience going into medical school as a vegetarian. And I don't know if you were you thinking about, that being an integral part of your practice when you were thinking about going to medical school?
That is the entire reason I went to medical school.
Huh.
And see, it's my medical school journey in medicine is very different from the typical experience. So, once I did go plant-based, I felt the effect immediately.
Hmm.
I felt I had energy. I did feel like my thinking was clearer. I required less sleep. As a teenager, my acne disappeared. And so it was immediately clear to me that, wow, this is a much better diet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, felt like I need to help people understand that this really is the way that we as humans should be eating. And so I had a very good friend. In fact, it was his family that introduced me to some of the Adventist Church. And Ronnie was a fantastic artist. And so we sat down, and I started doing lectures using posters. And he I got some pictures from some books, and he, you know, sort of transposed them into poster form on pictures of carnivores versus herbivores. And so I would kind of go around giving these lectures to willing listeners about why we should all be plant-based. And then when I decided to go to college, I came from a poor section of Oakland, and so I didn't go to college immediately after high school. It was about a four-year delay. And when I started, I thought about medicine because that would kind of be the natural way to help people understand about their health and change their health. But then I kind of thought, I'm already 4 years out. I want to go to medical school. That's another 8 years. I'll be too old. And then about 3 years into my undergraduate experience, I sort of realized, at that time, the projection was I'd be finishing med school around 32. Like, you're going to be 32 one day if you live. And boy, you'll be kicking yourself in the pants. if you turn around and realize, wow, by now, I could have been a doctor. So I decided that, and the reason I wanted to become a doctor was twofold. One, I wanted to get that really intimate and detailed understanding of human health and physiology so I could, again, really understand more fully how and why plant-based diets are better for us and to help people understand that. But also, I knew that if I weren't a doctor, even though doctors aren't taught a thing about nutrition, that my entire career, I would hear people tell me, oh, you can't tell me to stop eating meat because you're not a doctor. I'll become a doctor.
Yeah.
And so it was actually a relief to me when I began working to find out I actually enjoyed being a physician. Because that wasn't sort of the idea of practicing medicine wasn't my primary motivator. It was the idea of me being able to help educate people about changing their diet.
Huh.
So, yeah, things worked out very well in that.
Do you think it's been easy to convince your patients that they should go plant-based, or has it been difficult?
It depends. Because it depends on how sick they are. And then obviously there are, other factors like their personality type and so on. But the interesting thing is that sick people, particularly when they're very ill, are really ready to try, to do. I mean, many of them, I can't say all of them were, perhaps not even most, but many, many people, once they become really ill and frustrated, they are really ready to look at doing something differently and making a change. I remember there are several patients throughout my, career that stand out. One was a patient that I started taking care of back in the late 90s when I was working in a public health free clinic for uninsured patients in Alexandria, Virginia. And because that's something, that's one of the things that I had always made a personal commitment to do, is to work for underserved patients. Because, again, growing up, there were times when my family, because of, the fact of my parents' income, we needed to use Medicaid, public health insurance. And I had some, less than pleasant interactions with medical personnel. And so I just determined that I would spend, part of my career helping to bring the best quality care to people who were poor and often didn't receive that kind of care.
Yeah, that's great.
But, and so I was working in this free clinic, and a patient named Kathy, she was also a patient in the clinic, and it also just so happened that Kathy was a member of the same church that I was going to at the time, but she was seeing a different doctor in the clinic, and she had diabetes, and she was just very, very ill. And so she approached me one day and she said, listen, can I be your patient instead of the doctor that she was saying she did, because I'm just not getting better. And so I said, sure. And so when she came, you know, I remember our initial visit, and at that time she had been diagnosed with diabetes for over 17 years. She was on large doses of insulin twice a day, plus taking oral diabetic medication, and still her blood sugars would average somewhere between the mid-200s to 300 range. She had become disabled because she couldn't walk more than a block without severe cramping in her legs. She had heart disease. She was on 3 blood pressure medicines, and she would tell me that when she got up in the morning, her eyes would be so blurry from, you know, just the fact that her diabetes was out of control, and she would just feel so bad that she would have to sit on the edge of her bed for 15 minutes before she could even get up and try to start, doing her daily activities. And so I, you know, sat down and I talked to her about diet and design, the fact that, it was the standard American diet that was probably driving her diabetes, and that she needed to get back to a plant-based diet. And I'll be honest that I was hoping she would become vegetarian. But overnight, Kathy went vegan. She eliminated all animal products from her diet. And immediately, her blood sugars began dropping, plummeting. And fortunately, because we were both, you know, friends as well as doctor-patient, she had my personal cell phone number. And so she could call me and say, Dr. Mills, my blood sugar is too low. What do I do? And I quickly started weaning her off of all those medications she was on. We first got her off insulin and then got her off of the oral tablets. And over the next 6 to 8 weeks, she ended up coming off all of her diabetes medicines. And then eventually we got her off of 2 of her 3 blood pressure medicines. Over the next year, she lost 60 pounds without trying to just because of her diet. And eventually she was actually able to go back to work because the claudication or cramping in her legs actually resolved. And it was just an amazing transformation. And to see her get her life back and to be able to get back into life was just fantastic. But it was, again, the entire reason that I had gone into medicine. So it was a wonderful thing to see, experience, and be a part of.
Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, and the thing is that, as you said, it's that people can come to this realization. It's just sad that they have to be at such a low point in their health before they're willing to try it. I just wish that people could be a little more proactive.
Well, yeah, and I think that part of that is also our fault, meaning those of us in the health and medical profession, because we just don't give this information to our patients, and the usual reason that's given is people say, most people won't do it. Well, but that's not for a physician or practitioner to say. You don't know if somebody's going to do something until you tell them. And, the best nutrition advice that most patients get from their doctors is, you need to, eat more healthy, or you need to eat a better diet, which is really not any useful information. And that's because doctors, we are not taught about nutrition in medical school. And most doctors are abysmally ignorant about nutrition and the role that it can play. And so, I think a big part of helping people to change is we need to provide them better, more detailed and more useful information. And for that, we as clinicians need to be better educated ourselves.
Right, and it seems to, it needs to be a consistent message too. I mean, because just because somebody won't do it the first time doesn't mean you stop and say, "Oh, I'm not going to tell you not to smoke or you know, to give up, you know, heavy drinking." It's like, well, okay, sometimes you have to have that conversation many times, and people are going to try and they're going to fail and they're going to try and they're fail. But you know,
that's exactly right. And then you know, the other thing that I realized is that another reason. Physicians and other healthcare workers don't champion a plant-based diet is because they themselves don't want to have to do it.
And
because they're as addicted to, you know, all of this unhealthy food as everyone else, you know, they want to believe that moderation works. And so that's what they tell patients. And, you know, I ask people, I'm like, well, do you think you can shoot heroin or smoke crack in moderation? if something is unhealthy and destructive, moderation is not the way to deal with it.
Yeah.
Abolition. We have to stop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's a slippery slope, you know, just like with, like Tom said, with drinking. If you're an alcoholic, you know, it's, you can't really do it in moderation.
No, yeah. No, right.
So.
And, you know, I've heard Dr. Michael Greger use the analogy of, it's like getting kicked in the shin. You know, you might get kicked in the shin one day, and it'll hurt, but it'll clear up. But if somebody kicks you in the shin every day at the same spot three times a day, eventually you're going to have a big ulcer that's going to get infected and you're going to lose that leg. Well, and that's what we do to our bodies and our health when we eat unhealthy food three times every single day. But, if, you know, extending that analogy, it's not going to be that helpful if you decide, well, okay, I'm not going to let you kick me in my shin three times a day. I'm just going to let you do it once a day. Or I'm going to let you do it three times a week. I mean, you know what I mean? You're still going to be injuring yourself and creating disease. You have to stop the injury and allow your body to heal itself and not reinstitute that injury if you want to be healthy and continue to be healthy.
Right. You know, on a slightly different topic, I was thinking about, you know, when I was a teenager when I first learned about environmental racism, when they were thinking about doing the radioactive waste dump here at Sierra Blanca, and my brother was involved in that. And you know, we think about racism in the environment, and I think one of the areas that we haven't seen enough of, and I think it's impressive that you do, is shining a spotlight on, you know, racial bias and the federal nutrition policy and how those practices affect, you know,
the
so
health.
Many people in our country.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and what your, you know, your research has revealed and what you're hoping to accomplish by bringing attention to it.
Well, yes. Thank you for asking about that. And I just did a really comprehensive lecture on the impact of historical and society-wide racism on the health profiles of communities of color, and did a lot of, you know, reading, research, thinking, and it's very interesting because what you find when you look at how our government has dealt with ethnic minority communities historically, there's a recurring pattern where the people in these communities are taken from a situation of food security and independence, and through one means or another, placed in areas where they become food insecure and therefore dependent on the government for food handouts. And there's a reason the government does this, because it means that people become very, very docile when they have to rely on the government to provide the food they need to feed their families. And but then what the government does is, instead of providing healthy food, it uses these communities as dumping grounds for commodities and surpluses that have been created by agribusiness, wealthy businessmen, so that they can make money. So, for instance, you know, with African Americans, they took West Africans out of West Africa, brought them here, and made them slaves, and then turned around and fed them the garbage of the plantations, which were the entrails of the pigs, the pig's feet, the pig ears, and all of this, you know, unhealthy and less nutritious food. And then, even after slavery ended, they used, you know, Jim Crow laws, segregation, redlining, denying access to higher institutions, to higher learning, to keep blacks confined to these marginal areas in inner cities where, you know, they don't have access to good food, where economically they are kept unemployed or marginally employed, and again, therefore, become dependent on government food support programs, which then give them foods that, you know, like dairy foods, cheese, white rice, white flour, canned meat, sugar, and so on. With the Native Americans, Native Americans were, you know, a lot of people have heard peripherally of this phenomenon, the Trail of Tears. The Trail of Tears happened as part of the 1830 Indian Removal Act as a way of forcing the southeastern Indian nations off of land that they had cleared and were farming so that that land could be given to cotton plantations. And that was also, again, a way of making, of forcing the Indians on these reservations, which were deliberately placed on, you know, essentially unfarmable land, so that they became dependent on the government for handouts to feed their children. And again, it's a way of controlling people. But what were they given? Again, these unhealthy commodity crops, alcohol, and so forth, to keep them docile. And so, yes, that is a recurring pattern, and it does have a very negative impact on the health profiles of these communities of color.
We've been talking with Dr. Milton Mills, who's a critical care physician, and who serves as the race and nutrition specialist and board advisor for A Well-Fed World. We thank you very much, Dr. Mills, for your time today.
My pleasure.
Yeah, and Dr. Mills, could you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your work?
Sure. They can contact A Well-Fed World. I think it's awellfedworld.org. Or they can contact PCRM.org, which stands for Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. And they will find a lot of my lectures that are posted to YouTube. They go to YouTube and type in Dr. Milton Mills. I think there must be at least 20 short or longer lectures that are posted there on a variety.
Yeah, and check out your work in the film What the Health.
You know, I always forget about the films that I've done. Yeah, there's What the Health, there's Vegetated, and the latest film is A Prayer for Compassion. I'm in that as well.
Uh-huh. Great. Oh, wonderful.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining us.
And thanks for all that you do.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.